All right, wrapping up the third lecture of learning and cognition. Where we are now, Unit C. So because we're wrapping up, then this weekend we've got the reading assignment and the Canvas activity due Sunday. So that's the idea there. The timeline here is that today's lecture wraps up Unit C. Then we've got a three lecture unit on communication. So we're kind of covering the foundations of animal behavior before we go into that two-stage midterm. And so if we're counting forward, then today is Thursday, Tuesday and Thursday of next week, Tuesday of the week after that. The midterm review is just going to be bring your questions, and I will have, if there are no questions, then to help generate questions, I basically have selected kind of the greatest hits of each one of the lectures this semester so far, and we'll kind of go through that. And if that generates questions, we can stop and answer those. So that will be the Thursday of that week. And then stage one and stage two, this is the week before fall break. I think somebody said it's like October 6th or something like that. So just as a reminder, you don't have to come to class for either of those. They're Canvas based. If you do come to class, I will be in class or somebody will be in class proctoring both one and two, Tuesday and Thursday at this time. So if you do come to class for stage one, then bring a laptop so that you can work on that. It will be a lockdown browser exam. So that's an individual exam and it's timed. Whenever you start it, you get 90 minutes to finish it. If you come to this classroom, I can probably hang around for the full 90 minutes because it doesn't appear to be a class after this. But if there's some special event or people who are coming in, something I can do about that. So it's 90 minutes because the 75 minutes of class plus 15 minutes of technical difficulties, slop time. So that will be the Tuesday of that week before fall break. And then the Thursday of that week before fall break is the collaborative version, the exact same exam. You don't get your scores or the right answers between these two. You won't know your scores or the right answers until after stage two has completed. But on that Thursday, this is you can, but don't have to collaborate with anyone enrolled in the class. If you want to do that through Discord or Slack, that's fine too. Just I'm sort of trusting you to only the only people in that channel will be other people that are currently enrolled in the class. And you can use your notes, anything I've provided, so anything on Canvas and so on. For stage one, you can get one two-sided note sheet that you hand prepare. It can be typed, but I just no screenshots of anything. So that's kind of, and we'll keep talking about that as we move forward, but just a reminder of the timeline going forward. Questions? No, so two it's not timed. There's no lockdown. It's collaborative. So what some people like to do, but you don't have to do, but what some people like to do is you have it's open all day Thursday, and you can just keep coming back to it. But what some people like to do is since you've already got this time on your schedule, then they come here, maybe they plan a group of students, or maybe they just come and see who's here. And then they work on stage two together. So a lot of times you'll get like a distribution of students over here that just audibly are working together out, just discussing things back and forth. And there might be a couple of lone students that are over here just sort of working on it. And maybe occasionally they'll drift over or not. Whereas a lot of the rest of the class is just working on it elsewhere, and that's totally fine. So it's flexible on how to do that for stage two. For stage one, again, there will be someone here, so you have time to do stage one in a quiet environment. But honestly, a lot of people, when I do these two-stage exams, stage one, it's crickets in here. So a lot of times I'll come and I'll hang out for 15 minutes, and if nobody shows up, then I'll leave the room. But if somebody's here, then I'll sit here and just make sure that the room is quiet and everything is fine. But there's no re like you can come to class, but you don't have to. I'm also planning on increasing the availability to be more than one day for both of these. So like stage one, I think I'm actually going to probably open Monday and Tuesday, and then stage two, Thursday and Friday. And so that adds a little extra availability. I haven't decided on Wednesday yet. I'm leaning towards doing, say, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, stage one, Thursday, Friday, stage two. And again, also all Canvas based, so it can be completed remotely. It's a little bit of very flexible timing. So if you do have travel plans for fall break, I'm hoping this will help work around those. So any questions about that? The questions are the same. So you won't know the questions going into stage one. You'll take it and I allow you some scrap paper. So what a lot of people do after stage one is they'll say, oh, you know, questions 6, 10, and 14, those were kind of tricky. I'd like to sort of make sure that I go back and look into those. So you can write those down and, you know, you can record even content about those questions. And then in stage two, then you'll remember that, oh yeah, those were the ones that I wanted to go back and check. And so your score for your total midterm score that will go into Canvas, that will go into calculating the midterm's contribution to your final grade, will be 80% of the score for stage one plus 20% of the score for stage two. Yeah, it's an 80-20 split, the mixture. Yep. That will be handled in this, I'll cover that stuff in this midterm review, but if you'd like, you can look at the sample midterm from last fall. That should be available there. So there's a lot of resources in that midterm unit on Canvas. You do have to take a lockdown browser compliance assignment to open up that midterm unit. And that just makes sure that everybody's got a browser where they can take the midterm ahead of time. So if once you complete that, that'll open up the midterm module and there are resources in there to see what types of questions. And then as you've seen at the top of every unit, Unit C, Unit D, A, and B, they're a study guide, which basically when I generate questions, I just look at the study guides for A, B, C, and D. And if I say that you're supposed to come out of this unit knowing X, then I say, let me think of a question that tests me against X. So if you want to sort of know like where the questions are coming from, just look at that study guide. And if you feel like you can, that you can handle each one of those bullets of the study guide, then you're probably going to be well prepared for the questions I put together. And again, if you want a sample of that, I've got the exam from fall of 24 that is online. You can take a practice version of it as many times as you want. You can look at the solutions. So that's available too. Other questions? All right. So moving into our last unit on learning and cognition, we've been moving gradually from outside to inside. So the pure behaviorism is focused on how an animal responds to outside cues, a little more innate behavior. As we start moving into learning, then it's how those outside cues and rewards create plasticity, change the animal's responses. And then finally, when we move into cognition, now we're moving into not just cues from the outside, but cues from the inside. So are there variables that are changing inside the animal that we need in order to better explain the animal's behavior? So knowing what's going on the outside maybe doesn't help us explain all of the animal's behavior. So one example of this, one classical example of this from early days in cognition is the study of motivation. So what do I mean by that? So if we look at, this is a classic example of elephant must. So must for these elephants is this periodic state, usually around when they're mating, that they become extremely aggressive. So the male elephant, characterized by aggressive behavior, usually connected with the rutting season. So they become extremely dangerous. They can start, just attacking fences that are nearby, other individuals. You don't want to be around an elephant when it's going through must. And so, we're going to say, well, what's going on with this must? And so that's what, it brings up this idea of what's motivating this elephant. And so applied behaviorists use this term redirected behavior. And so this is direction of a behavior away from an intended appropriate target to a less appropriate third party or inanimate object. So the prevailing theory behind must, about the thought processes going on in this giant mammal, is that it is motivated to mate, but it is unable to express the mating motivation or express the mating to another individual. And instead, it redirects that energy and that activity towards other objects. And so it now starts attacking other objects because it's pent up reproductive energy that it is redirecting towards other things. So so-called redirected behavior. So we're starting to get this idea that there's something inside the elephant that is driving its behavior, not just purely something outside the elephant. And that is sort of leaning toward this idea of cognition. So again, we got now, this is borrowed from the applied behavior literature, this idea of redirected behavior. And there are other examples of that. So you have preening, for example, many fowl like this, or many animals actually, obsessively scratch or preen, particularly when conflicted about simultaneous motivational drivers. So you might have a juvenile duck, and you have all of its, it may have been hanging out in a group of its siblings, and they're over here. It may have its parent, which is over here, and it is stuck between them. And then when it's stuck between them, it starts preening itself. And again, from the applied behaviorist perspective, the heuristic that they view is that this is so-called displacement behavior. So it's an irrelevant task. So it's sort of this emergent task that happens when the desired behavior cannot be completed. So it's this idea that maybe the juvenile duck wants to be in two places at one time. It would like to go with its siblings over here, but it also is feeling like that would maybe put it make it unsafe, so it wants to stay with its parent. But it's now not sure what to do, and so a third behavior, there's instead of going with the parent is one behavior, going with siblings is another behavior, a third behavior pops up, and so it's a so-called displacement behavior. This is an irrelevant task that just emerges because of the tension between two other tasks that aren't possible. So this is also shows up like in lower ranking animals and social hierarchies. So you find that when you're in a high ranking individuals, like so in their primate hierarchies, for example, if primates get demoted into lower rank so that they don't have access to many resources, they generally don't have as much freedom in their groups to move around, then they start self-grooming much more often. So that's thought of as a displacement behavior because they can't do the things that they maybe could do if they were in that higher ranking position. Humans, you see this a lot. So you go to a party, you see someone that you maybe you're attracted to, and but you're unsure of how to approach this person and don't feel it's appropriate, or there are a number of different challenges there. And so a human then starts touching their hair or their face, picking their nails, doing these things that are a displacement behavior. So it's a little different than the must behavior where it's, lashing out. It's this sudden irrelevant behavior that doesn't seem to be related to the motivations, but the motivations cannot be met. And so this displacement behavior comes out. So, this displacement behavior can be strongly repetitive and stereotyped. So they become pathologically, so they can turn into these tics and they can get to the point of self-harm. You can get animals that preen themselves bald or give themselves irritations and things like that because of too much of these behaviors. And so it can become very repetitive and very stereotyped, self-directed behaviors that are unhealthy for the animal. But applied behaviorists are not just interested in the direct, they view this as a symptom of something else. So yeah, if you notice that your dog is licking their feet a whole lot, it could be an allergy thing, or it could be a displacement behavior that is a result of some other underlying cause. And so applied behaviorists, when they go to zoos and things like that, if they notice a lot of displacement behaviors, they start looking around and they say, is there something off in the enclosure? When did this behavior start? Was it after the introduction of another animal? Was it after the loss of another animal? Those sorts of things. And so these end up being indications that there might be some fixes that need to be made around the animal to help prevent it from doing so much of this displacement behavior. And if those fixes aren't made, this displacement behavior, if it's a self-directed behavior, can lead to the animal potentially harming itself. It goes into this pathological nature here, and it's not because there's something wrong with the animal. It's because of the environment around the animal is creating a very stressful situation that is leading the animal to behave in this irrelevant and harmful way. That's the applied behaviorist kind of view on this. So, any questions about this so far? This idea that we need to think not only about the external cues, but how they interact with internals, and then actually use the internals as a reflection to look back at the externals to say, how do these two things interact? And maybe that helps explain the behavior. Yeah. Well, I would say that there are repetitive behaviors. Like there could be like a child might keep hitting its parent, and that might be like whenever it's feeling shy or whatever, whenever it's feeling bashful, whatever, it hides its face on its parent or something like that. So, and it could just keep doing that. You're like, get off my leg, kid, but it just keeps coming back. And so that would be a repetitive behavior, but it's not self-directed. But when the repetitive behaviors become self-directed, then it opens up the potential for self-harm. If picking nails or something like that, eventually you pick your whole nail off, or your nails start bleeding or something like that, then that's an example of a pathological self-directed behavior, which so it started out as a displacement behavior, like I was a little nervous, I picked my nail, but then now I'm nervous all the time. So then it becomes highly repetitive and stereotyped. Like, so stereotyped, and we're gonna learn about this in communication. When we talk about stereotypy, we mean that a behavior becomes decoupled from any physiological basis of the behavior. Me talking is an example of stereotyped behavior. At one point in time, there was some proto-human that didn't talk, but it made noises just as part of the physiology of breathing. And eventually those noises got stereotyped into communication. So that's what I mean by stereotyped. They were decoupled from the physiological basis. So we got this displacement behavior becomes highly repeated and stereotyped. It's like there's no physiological reason for it to happen. And if it happens to be self-directed and highly repeated, then it could put the animal at danger to itself. Does that make sense? Any other questions? Okay, so motivation there. One of the early models of motivation was drive theory. And so this is a we call a phenomenological model. So it has nothing to do with the underlying mechanisms, but it is an assumed model that just seems to work in order to help explain some of the patterns. And so the thought is that maybe inside an animal, there's drive energy in quotes here that flows into a tank. There's not a real tank inside the animal, but it's a thought that there could be something like that. And that energy, as it accumulates in the tank, has outlets to come out of the tank. And when it comes out of the tank, that's actually behaviors that occur. So if you've got this tank, it might have three outlets. And if it comes out of each one of these, then that's three different behaviors. So it comes out of one, you get one behavior, another, get another behavior, and so on. So if you come up with different shapes of these tanks, like this one here, then it's this idea that high priority activities drain energy first, low priority activities receive energy only if it's available. So now we start seeing where this could start looking, being a mechanistic explanation for things like displacement behavior. And so it's this idea that if the energy normally comes out of this lower one, if something blocks it, then it will accumulate and then start coming out of this one. And if it's coming out slowly on this one, then you might get these other behaviors that occur. So again, this isn't saying that this is actually like there's a pool of something inside the brain of the animal, but early models of motivation thought that this drive theory, you could come up with these kind of reservoir structures that would help explain the patterns that you saw and provided just a tool for reasoning about, oh, how do we unplug this here? Like, if you go to a zoo, you see an animal doing something that doesn't normally do, then in that case, maybe you figure out, oh, is there another, that other behavior? Is it just unable to do that behavior? And if it is, we unplug that, then we'll have an option for that drive energy to get out of the tank And that'll stop it from doing this other behavior that would normally be a lower priority behavior. That was the theory, this drive theory. Questions about this idea? It's just supposed to be a conceptual model to help explain patterns, not saying that there's actually these things inside the head of the animal. Well, it's not quite, it's more of drive theory is more about not that you do this more and eventually you do this so much that you start doing this other thing. It's more of if there's something that prevents you from doing this one, then it's like you put a little cork in this and the fluid that's coming in can't get out. So it accumulates. And once it gets higher and higher in the tank, then other behaviors start showing up. It's the idea there. There are, yeah, go ahead. There's a question. Well, you know, that's so the idea in this figure, and this is just a sample figure, is that this is the generic model that you're going to have reservoirs that, and these are supposed to be valves. So these valves are closed and this valve is open. But the thought here was that if you have these reservoirs, you can create different reservoir shapes to explain different patterns that you see in nature. So if you're saying like, I notice that whenever an animal can't do this one thing, then eventually it starts doing this other thing. And if you keep it from doing that thing, it starts doing this other thing. Then they're saying, well, that's explained. It's as if this animal is explained by this shape. But you can come up with other shapes that might explain other patterns you see in other types of animals. And that was the kind of the idea behind drive theory, is how do you come up with shapes that explain the motivational patterns, or how motivation ends up coming out through different behaviors. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so the semantics here, so and maybe priority is not the best word. This is a figure that I borrowed. I would say it's, the reason they say priority is it's like, if you can do anything, then it's the idea that the animal will tend to do this lower one first. But if it's prevented from doing that, then these become secondary activities that are only displayed when the primary activities aren't able to be done. So that's what, so sorry, an example would be like the juvenile duck, it is motivated to go and see its parent, but it is also motivated to go and see its offspring. So there's a kind of a reservoir model here where you could say like, well, then there's preening. Well, it normally doesn't do preening. It normally just would move towards its motivation. But now that it's got these motivations moving in these locomotion motivations in different directions, it's almost as if it blocks off the behavior to move. And if it can't move, if it's sitting there wanting to move, but it can't move, then it's the thought is that it gets so anxious that it builds up drive energy and it gets so high that eventually it pours out the preening direction. So normally you wouldn't observe preening, but if you block off the ability to move, then suddenly preening shows up. Other questions? This isn't necessarily how people think. I think there's a lot of applied behaviorists that find this to be a useful conceptual tool, and they still use this to sort of think about, you know, like it's more a descriptor, like we notice with this particular animal that reservoir shaped this way is a good conceptual model for how we might, you know, structure their environment to keep them healthy. But again, it's not inferring anything specific about the head of the animal. And that kind of gets to this idea that, you know, that raises an interesting question, is that if this does seem to be very good at reproducing patterns you see in real animals, then it raises these mechanistic questions of how is that working? What is actually the process inside the brain that might produce that? But the cognitive people, when cognitive science was first forming, there weren't as many tools to investigate those sorts of things, but they needed to make progress. And these models tended to be helpful and making progress. And so that's where we got this separation of the mind and the body. So this thought that, yes, there's a biological underpinning, but we don't know enough about the biology. It's too complex, but these types of models tend to help explain patterns that we see. So we can create this dualism where we assume that there is some mechanistic, some mind, which need not be directly connected to the wetware of what's inside the body. Of course, it at some point does need to be, but these cognitive models move forward without worrying as much about what's going on in the body. It's focused on asserting these abstract things that we're just gonna say they're built somehow and they exist in the mind. And we're gonna assume that those things are just as tangible as physical things that are outside the world or the things inside the body. So the behaviorists were very much interested in, you know, the real physical things are outside in the world, how they interact with the real physical animal. And cognitive scientists said, that's fine, but especially when you start looking at humans, it's very difficult to boil things down in a reductionist way to just the physical things that we can observe. It became much more useful to assume there are things we can't observe that are driving behaviors. And that was the foundation of the beginning of cognitive science. So that's kind of where we are here, is that Skinner and colleagues, they had their behaviorism. They're interested in things like associative learning, where we're really focused on the outside of the animal, going into the animal and how that maybe changes the animal, but it's less about these unobserved states. Enter Noam Chomsky and others that were very important individuals in beginning the cognitive science. And they said, you know what, there's this separate thing called thinking. There's the body, and then there's the mind. And in the mind, we have this separate process of thinking where there are unobservable internal mental states that can drive behavior, internal sources of stimuli. So if you're importing a lot of the ideas of behaviorism, associative learning, operant conditioning, classical conditioning, but instead of putting the stimuli purely outside, you're allowing stimuli to come from inside, just like drive theory did. And so the claim, Chomsky would say, is that these internal states are necessary to explain human language. So he was interested in linguistics and how humans form language and commonalities across language. And if just using behaviorism alone, it wasn't possible for him to explain language, and said, so we have to assume that there's actually internal mental states that are decoupled from the outside world. And those internal mental states, once we have those, it's much easier to understand how language emerges, it evolves, is used, and so on and so forth. What is cognition, or what is a cognitive mind? Well, it's hard to define, just like behavior is hard to define. This is sort of a general list. We think of a cognitive mind, or we think that cognition is involved when we assume that a mind is aware of itself and its place in the surrounding environment. So if you can understand an animal's behavior purely by assuming that it's a response to those things around it, and it doesn't need to know that it is different than those things around it, then maybe that's not cognitive. But at the point where an animal recognizes that it is in the environment and is different from the environment, then that awareness of itself, you know, is a cognitive property. Similarly, the awareness of the thinking of others. And so we're going to talk about how you test for awareness of the thinking of others. And that we view as a cognitive property. The ability to forecast events in the future. So again, that's decoupled from current stimuli. So being able to know that tomorrow at noon, a certain thing's gonna happen. And maybe the next day at 1 p.m., another thing's gonna happen. And so preparing for that, anticipating that, view that as a cognitive property. Solving problems, emotions, which kind of is like a more advanced version of drive theory, this idea of this internal state that is driving behavior, empathy, which is sort of the awareness of other people's emotions, and then intuition and insight. So mental trial and error learning. We've talked about the scrub jay that, you know, is able to play with different physical objects and get into them. Now, what if it's able to just look at an object and do that play in its mind? And then after doing a bunch of that play, going and trying something out in the physical world, where you do a lot of the iterations in the mind, view that as a cognitive property. It doesn't need the physical feedback. So that's what we mean. That's what we're getting to mean by cognition, the ability of an animal to separate itself from the current moment and contemplate the past, predict the future, and act accordingly. So we're going to see examples of that. That's all today's about. But any questions so far about this idea? And it's a controversial idea. I think a lot of behavioral ecologists are not huge fans of cognitive science because it's a little squishier, and a lot of times there are alternative explanations that can ground things back into more fundamental behavior. But it's compelling. We've heard Tolman for last time. He talked about latent learning and how these rats learned cognitive maps. Tolman, by the way, was also did foundational work in behavioral genetics. So he studied if you had a rat that was really good at a maze and another rat that was really good at a maze, and you bred them, then would the offspring also be good at that maze? So going back to our idea of behavioral genetics, Tolman was doing that sort of stuff. But Tolman came up with this idea of the cognitive map. So one of the earliest kind of examples of cognition in non-human animals comes from this idea here. But since then, people have said, well, you know what? You don't actually need a cognitive map to explain the patterns that you saw in those rats. There are complicated but still plausible ways that you could explain the rat's behavior just by the stimuli that it receives within the maze, delayed rewards, things like that that don't require it to build an entire map in its head. But that's at least one hypothesis of what the map's doing, or what the rat is doing, is building that map in its head. So, but that is an example of a cognitive property. The rat realizes that this thing exists, and it builds a model in its head, and it uses that model to help make predictions to act in the future based on that new model. All right. So, if we talk about where, cognitive science, how does it break down? Well, here's our definition of cognition. This is again kind of a mind-body split. Now that we have more sophisticated methods, then we have, cognitive psychology, which is really the focus on these mental processes specifically. So I mean, they're interested that there's a biological backing, but that's not the key focus of cognitive psychology. We're really just asserting that these mental pathways exist, and we forget about that way we can sort of try different hypothetical mental pathways without ever having to actually find that biological substrate. Now, once you have a mental pathway that seems to be very explanatory, works very well, it does raise mechanistic questions about, well, where the heck is it built? And that's where we got cognitive neuroscience. And so here you have neurobiologists who are trying to not just explain, behavior, or just the standard sort of questions about ethology, but they're trying to understand these cognitive processes over here. So if you said that, wow, these mental states, like emotion is a very powerful explanatory concept for humans. So a cognitive neuroscientist will say, where is emotion stored in the brain? Where is it grounded in the brain? So a psychologist is, how does emotion motivate behavior? A cognitive neuroscientist is, where do you actually find that emotion? So these have become kind of tiers of cognitive science. And then what sort of greatly relates to this class animal behavior is comparative psychology. And there are several comparative psychologists, Federico Sanabria, for example, Jessica Verput, there's several, arguably Clive Wynne. So these are researchers here at ASU who they're fully embedded in the Department of Psychology, but they do experiments with non-human animals in order to make inferences that are sort of bigger than that species, the sort of inferences about learning in general, about psychology in general, and so on. So comparative psychologists study mental processes of non-human animals, particularly with respect to animal behavior. Now, with that in mind, a comparative psychologist is usually very cautious to invoke cognition. So that's where we talk about anthropomorphism. So anthropomorphism is the uncritical attribution of human characteristic to non-human animals. This is something that you want to try to avoid. This is saying, like, just because you solve a problem that way, that doesn't mean the rat solves it that way. But if you come up with a model where you're projecting your internal human experience onto the rat, then, that maybe isn't the best way to go. And so that brings up so-called Morgan's canon or the law of parsimony. And so in comparative psychology, if you have a bunch of different explanations for behavior, and some of them require cognitive elements, thinking elements, the higher psychological elements, but other explanations, which seem nearly equally valid, don't require those, then Morgan's canon says you go with the ones that are less cognitive. So, in no case is an animal activity to be interpreted in terms of higher psychological processes if it can fairly be interpreted in terms of processes which stand lower in the scale of psychology, evolution, and development. So, that's the idea of this law of parsimony. And I think there was a question several lectures ago when we started to bring up, thinking states that gets to this idea that if you have an explanation which you could say, well, the animal is doing a bunch of these calculations, but an equally valid explanation is that they're not, but they're responding to this particular cue that's repeatable in the environment. Then, absence of any other evidence, it's usually preferred that you go to the less cognitive explanation. It's just more parsimonious, less assumptions. Any questions about this, these ideas, or even why Morgan's canon is thought to be a good thing? Okay. All right. So, example one. This is one that I brought up earlier. So, mental time travel is something that you look for in animals as an example of cognition. And so, we've got this coconut octopus here, coconut octopus, veined octopus, and it happens to, when it finds coconut shells, it will carry those shells around with it. So it moves around, like this, for example, kind of just scooting along on its coconut with its legs, moving it along the floor. And occasionally it will come to some threatening object or stimulus, and it'll pull itself inside the coconut, kind of like a little hermit crab, and get protected by the coconut. And so one thought here is that it is doing mental time travel where it's saying, I might be in a risky situation later. This thing could protect me from that. Let me pick up this thing and then I'll carry it with me. And hours later, I'll be able to use it in order to protect myself. And so, this separation of when it started this behavior and when it actually then used the object that it picked up suggests that maybe there's a cognitive explanation that it's doing mental time travel. It's trying to protect against the risks of the future. That is one way we can explain that, and that is a cognitive explanation. But the worry when we do that is that we might confound proximate explanations and ultimate explanations. There might be a simple mechanism that says, that makes these coconut octopuses, whenever they see coconut shells, they pick them up. And it's just that's the mechanism. They just see kind of hard things that are shaped kind of curves. Maybe they look like old conch shells or something like that. There's something about them. And you could test that. You could go into the lab and you could see, is there a tendency for them to pick up certain shaped objects? And they just have that tendency to pick up that object. And the thought might be that octopus or octopi or octopuses, those that didn't have that tendency tend to get killed off because they aren't protected later. Those that did have that tendency, that trait then spreads through the population, and then suddenly the coconut octopus, they're all carrying around coconuts. That explanation doesn't require us to assume that the coconut octopus is actually thinking about its fate in the future. It's tempting to do so because we know ultimately the function, the reason why this trait spreads through the population is that the coconut provides protection. And we as humans try to think that we're smart and clever and planning, and we put on our seatbelts when we get in the car, those sorts of things, because we're trying to do that mental time, the what if scenarios. We're trying to do that mental time travel. And so we might project that onto the octopus, and maybe the octopus is doing that. But we should be cautious about that. And the claim would be that there's ways to test these things, that there might be ways to say that here is the one special case in the laboratory that if they're cognitive, they'll do one thing. But if they're just responding to cues from the environment, they'll do another thing. And if we can try that special case up, it may be impossible to find that case in nature, but if we can find that one special case in the lab and pit these two explanations against each other, then we'll finally say, okay, now it's got to be cognitive. But in the absence of that evidence, then usually it's Morgan's canon would suggest it's better to assume there is a simple proximate mechanism that just happens to have this function that has kept it in the population. Questions about that distinction? How you can have an octopus doing an apparently smart thing, but not using a smart mental model to do it. Does that make sense? So what I would say is, so a lot of times people think, well, a cognitive process is what a smart process. So you could say, wow, that's really smart that the octopus picked up the coconut because then it gave it the protection later. But that might not be because the octopus was actually being smart. It just has a tendency to hoard coconut shells. And it's in an environment where that provides it protection. Other questions. Great example of G by E as well. So it's almost like the cognitive explanation is all G, all gene, all internal to the object. But the this explanation, this more reductionist explanation, is more G by E, where the benefit really comes from just the right situation externally and just the right mechanism internally. And those come together, and that's where the function comes into play. So you might imagine that if you had an aquarium with these octopi in it and they never, ever experienced risk, then maybe they'd stop picking up coconuts. But if they're being cognitive, because they say, well, I never experienced it. It's really costly for me to carry this thing around. I'm just going to stop picking up coconuts. But if there was instead just this trait, this just innate trait that I just got to pick up coconuts, then regardless of how safe the aquarium was over the whole life, they just continue to pick up the coconuts. And so that's maybe an example of how you could tease these two things apart. Okay. Other example, so this is a more recent example. I'm going to show some videos here. It's about bumblebees. So this comes from a lab of Lars Čipka, who's sort of a famous bumblebee researcher who studies cognitive questions in bees. Bumblebees and honeybees, but sort of more well known for a lot of his bumblebee work recently, for actually several decades. And so the idea here is that he can train bumblebees to do pretty cool things. And I could talk a lot about those experiments. They can play soccer, things like that. Just search for Lars Čipka bumblebee soccer, and you'll see how he's trained bumblebees to roll around soccer balls. And when they get them into goals, they get sugar rewards. And then they teach other bumblebees how to do this as well. So that's not the example I'll talk about here, but encourage you to look that up. Example here, he's got this disc that's got a little bit of sugar water reward here. It's under a plastic slide or a glass slide. And over time, the bumblebee will learn that it can pull that disc out and then drink from it. What they also could do is train bumblebees to look for this string, pull the string out, and eventually, once it pulls this little string or rope out, then it will drink from it. And so this. It's very easy to well, not it's not that easy, but it's very reproducible. You can get bumblebees to do this. And the question is, are they being cognitive? So are they understanding ends and means? So do they see this little rope and do they say that I understand that there's on the end of this, there's a feeder. And if I pull on this rope, then I eventually get a feeder, and that, you know, so the ends to the means to get the feeder is to pull on the rope, and the ends are this thing here. So they've done similar experiments with primates and so, and elephants and so on. So try to understand ends and means reasoning. So you train them to do that, and then you go into a testing phase. And so what we'll see here when I start this video is, if you look closely, we've got these different setups, and so these all have the feeders under the glass. Some of them have an intact rope. Some of them have a broken rope where the rope is positioned there, but if you were to pull on the rope, nothing, it wouldn't pull this thing out here. So after you've trained the bee on these different conditions, so maybe you've trained it on the with rope or the without rope. So let's assume this bee, this bumblebee was trained on the with rope. Then you can have them, you can see how often they visit these feeders and attempt to get the feeder out. And you can count how often do they go to the rope or the intact rope or the cut rope. So you can see that, you know, this bee is going to try this one. And I think in these testing phases, they're actually glued down, so they don't get any feedback from the rope, but they can conceivably see through the glass and see what's going on there. And you can see that this particular bumblebee seems to pretty much just visit the intact ropes. And occasionally I think goes to one of the broken ones, but almost all the other ones, it's going to the intact ropes. Why is this ecologically relevant? It turns out that bees have to solve similar problems when they visit. They don't visit every flower. They have to visit flowers that some of them are full, some of them are not. And there are cues that they may have to learn, try to understand, like, oh, well, okay, I shouldn't waste my time with this flower. So the thought is there ends and means reasoning going on with that foraging? And so we set up a laboratory experiment to try to test for that. So they did a bunch of these tests. And so these here are, you know, so you can see, like, you know, they were trained without the rope, trained with the rope. So that's on the left side of each of these experiments. And then you can see the experiment. So here you've got, this is like the same one I showed you with a straight rope, but you've got disconnected versus connected. There are other examples down here where the rope, the straight rope that's connected actually has a bunch of curls in it or coils in it, whereas the one that's disconnected is straight. Other examples where, like, maybe during training, they blocked off, they put a black piece of tape over this area so it can't see the rope and where it's connected to the feeder. So there's a bunch of these examples here. And the results, so we're going to focus in on, like, so like here you see coiled strings in testing, but not in training. And then likewise, coiled strings in testing, but not in training. Here, both of these are coiled. Here, only the live feeder is coiled. So, you know, you can look to see how they make sense. So this is, this here would suggest if they can solve this problem. So if in experiments 8 and 9, they can solve this problem, it suggests that they're doing more than just responding to the look of the rope. This suggests that they know that, ah, a rope provides me an ends, provides me a means to get the sugar ends. All right, so what do the results end up looking like here? Well, here are the first, these are experiments 1 through 6. And so in experiment 1 here, you see that this bee didn't end up deciding between these here. So it was trained without a rope. And when it was trained on just a disc, if you give it an example of a broken rope and a full rope, then this here is, so these data points are how often it visited the, so each data point here is a different bee. And so this bee 100% of the time went to the feeder that it could, the good feeder. These bees 100% of the time went to the bad feeder. And so as you can see here, if you look at this box plot, this thing overlaps 50%, which means this bee that was trained without the rope couldn't solve the problem. So the rope apparently carries information, because all of these bees that were trained with ropes, so, you know, these were trained with white ropes, these were trained with different color ropes, this was trained with a rope, but it was a rope behind the black tape. All of them, when you then tested them on these cases down here, where the good feeder was a straight rope, they all went to the good feeder. So that's positive. It shows they're learning something. They can do this. But when you then give them, they're trained in these cases, similar to these cases, but then you give them these coiled ropes here. So we've got, so this one, they couldn't see the rope, And so this was kind of the standard test, but they weren't trained without the end of the rope here. This one, they were given a rope, but they got coiled on the live and straight on the dead. This one, they're both coiled. And in these cases, it went back to chance. So it doesn't, this result suggests that there's definitely associative learning going on. Classical behavior is an explanation here. There doesn't appear to be ends and means reasoning going on here. So this experiment was motivated by looking for a cognitive explanation for how these bees were doing it, but these results suggest that it's probably not best to use a cognitive model, an ends and means reasoning. It's probably more like a matching. They're just matching things that they see, and that seems to better explain the behavior. And that's the result that they end up saying here, that they think it relies on a combination of image matching and associative learning rather than means end understanding. These insights contribute a deeper understanding of the cognitive processes employed by bumblebees. I really like that sentence there, because it really shows how researchers get a negative result, but they still want to make it sound like a positive result. So they showed that there's not cognition going on, but they said by showing that there's not cognition going on, it provides insight in the cognition of a bumblebee. So they could still claim that they're studying the cognition of a bumblebee, even though their results showed that they're not cognitive, which is just which is also why this well, I won't get into it, but it's interesting, the marketing of research results. But it's still a cool result, even if you ignore this last sentence. Like, it's pretty neat that it was a cool setup, and it was interesting to see that the bees could solve this problem, and it was interesting to see that when they needed the cognition, it just wasn't there. So I think that was kind of cool. So Morgan, they are abiding by Morgan's canon, at least here, arguably not here, but they are abiding by Morgan's canon here, saying, it's probably associative learning. All right, questions about that result? Yeah. That's well, so yeah, so when they say like a combination of image matching and associative learning, yeah, you could think of it as you can use the models. I'd say it's probably so in this case, yeah, you could think of it as like you can operant conditioning provides a useful lens to sort of say that when a bee does this behavior that it's never done before, like pulling on the rope, it gets a sugar reward. And so that ends up getting paired with the stimulus of seeing a straight rope. So it's this combination. I think there's probably two things going on. It's probably operant conditioning to get them to pull on the rope, which is something they would never do in nature, plus classical conditioning to associate seeing the rope with doing that behavior. So that's why just in general, they just say associative learning, kind of both of those combined. But not, you don't have to assert that there's some mental state of the bee that's involved. Other questions about that? Great. All right. So sometimes the causal questions the cognitive perspective provides are more value than the hypotheses. So I think this is a really cool study. I think it was great to sort of think like, wow, bees are solving complex challenges when they're foraging on flowers. And as they're solving these complex challenges foraging on flowers, then maybe cognition could help them with that. Totally reasonable set of research questions to go by. And then, it ends up with this result. Like, it really could have turned out the other way. It really could have turned out that they do have this ends and means. And it could be that bumblebees do have cognitive processes that are just better. They show up more, they're expressed more in other cases. So, but yeah, I think without the cognitive idea, I don't think this study would have even. They wouldn't even come up with the idea for this study. So I think it's a valuable study, valuable results, but it so happens to be that the explanation wasn't cognitive, but I don't think that's a failure of the study. So that's one thing that cognitive science gives us. Even if, as animal behaviorists, we're very skeptical of cognitive explanations, we really like the cognitive questions. Any questions about that? What I mean by that? Okay. Questions in general. All right, I think I've got a clicker. All right. Okay, so elephant must is an example of which of these? So this comes back from the motivation section that motivated the cognition. Is it displacement behavior, redirected behavior, self-directed behavior, or stereotyped behavior? So remember, elephant must, that was the property where elephants during mating time, they go and they become very aggressive toward anything that gets in their path. They can take down fences, they can take down humans, they can take down other elephants. So they become really aggressive. They release this aggression toward other things. So do we view that as a better example of displacement, redirected, self-directed, or stereotyped behavior? So go ahead and wrap up your answers. Maybe another 10 seconds to complete the minute. 5 seconds. All right, so let's see results here. So it looks like most people suggested redirected behavior, and I bet there's a side lobe. Yeah, so there's a significant number of answers for displacement. Most people said redirected, and there's a couple more scattered around here. This one is one that whenever I look at this question, I have to think through it a little bit, and I get confused between these two as well. But to me, ultimately, I come down to, well, it's redirected behavior. That would be my answer to this, because it's not a novel behavior that sort of comes up only when it can't do other behaviors. It's true that it can't mate, but it's almost like they view the must as it's sort of just trying to release that mating energy on something else. It just happens to be an inappropriate target. So it's not like it's a new behavior that is coming up because it can't do another behavior. That would be displacement behavior. It's like it is the mating behavior. It just can't complete. So that mating behavior ends up coming out as this sort of aggressive release. But if it was able to mate, a very sort of similar behavior would lead to that mating. That's sort of the idea there. These are fuzzy terms. That's part of the problem with cognition is, these mental states, they're not physically grounded in things. And so sometimes it's hard to sort of tell the difference between one and another. Psychology is full of those things, full of nuance. So, but that's what I would go with redirected behavior. Questions about that? Okay. Oh, and now everybody went to redirected behavior. Really, these are not graded for correctness. I really should just stop before I do that. Okay. All right. Other examples of things that we do as animal behaviorists to look for cognitive properties. So this is, I think Anushka is familiar with this video. We were in a field site in Australia when the neighbor had this kookaburra that would come by, and it would always come by at like 5 o'clock. And there were these power lines that were across. We were in this Airbnb field site was nearby. This is Anushka's field research, and there was these fruit bats that were across the street, and that's sort of a side thing. It was just kind of cool, this colony of fruit bats, and power lines were across them, and these two blue-winged kookaburras would go. They're a type of kingfisher. They're really big birds. They make some pretty interesting noises, especially a different species of kookaburra around there. And it would come and hang out on these power lines starting at like 4:45 p.m. And like every day it would show up at like 4:45 p.m. because around 5 p.m., this neighbor of our Airbnb would bring out these chunks of meat and would just put it down here along the edge. And then when she came out, as she started just, forking this stuff out that she just cut up in her kitchen, the two kookaburras would just come and sit in front of her and wait for her to feed it. And so, this is not the behavior sort of I'm focusing on here, but this idea that they always showed up about 15 to 20 minutes before that resident came in here. So that's an idea of this idea of chronesthesia, the awareness of the past and the future, and the use of that information in the present. So these two kookaburra were aware, they seemed to be aware of the time of day and would use that time of day to use that to would use episodic memory. So we've already talked about that in previous lecture, memory of individual experiences at particular times and places. So they remembered that, oh, at least a couple of times in the past, around 5 o'clock, whatever 5 o'clock means to a kookaburra, I got fed. And so I now use that awareness of time. I know 5 o'clock, so I can now show up around 4:45. I don't want to show up too late because maybe the other kookaburra will eat everything, or maybe it just, maybe when they don't see me, they'll take the food away. Who knows what the reasoning is, if there is any reasoning. But this is the idea, at least. It really seems like these kookaburra, they had this consistent awareness of time. And that's what we mean by time place learning and anticipation. So this idea that you can learn to associate a reward or a behavioral consequence with a specific location and time and use that information to return. That time place learning, in order to study time place learning, we look for anticipation, consistent change of behavior before any external cues of the event are made available. It's possible that maybe this kookaburra can, I don't know, hear her cutting up this meat in the kitchen inside this, but I doubt it. There's, the door is sliding glass door is closed. I think they actually probably show up before she preps it. Probably no, she preps it a different time of day. I don't know. We didn't talk to her exactly about when she prepped it, so it seems like they were anticipating that she was going to come out and feed them. So that is an example of if you see anticipation, you often then can maybe make an inference of so-called time place learning, which is an example of mental time travel, which we view as a cognitive property of an animal. And there's other examples of that. Any questions about the kookaburra example here? Okay. So the author of the textbook, Mike Breed, so they did this example with stingless bees. And it was very, very similar to the kookaburra example. They went down to Panama, or maybe to Costa Rica, and they would put out a feeder that was near, but not right next to, a stingless bee colony. And they would put out that feeder at, I think, noon every day. And so it was presented, so feeder presented each day at a particular time. And then they would see how many stingless bees showed up at that feeder. And what they would find is that after a pre-treatment, like they would, they'd put it out for like a week or something like that. And then in the next week, they started gathering these data. And they would say every day, about 20 minutes before when they put the feeder out, you'd start getting stingless bees showing up at the feeder or at the location of where the feeder was going to be. And they would show up there and then they'd put the feeder out and then you'd get a ramp up of these stingless bees. But this is the kind of the point is that you saw this signs of anticipation. And then the week later, they took the feeder away. They stopped showing up at, or they stopped providing the feeder at noon. And so what you found is that the bees did show up before noon, similar to like they did here. But then, when after noon, when no feeder showed up, then you got no increase in the bees. So it really seemed like they were responsive to the food being provided at noon. They were anticipating it, and then they were updating their memory based on that and based on the outcome of those events. So this was a suggestion that maybe, now who knows, is it time place learning in the bee or in the bee colony? We don't know where memories, when we see colony level phenotypes in social insects, we don't know the mechanism of the memory. It could be that a could be, so to speak, that so many bees actually have their own individual memories and they bring other bees with them. Or it could be some weird demographic, it could be some like storage of memories somehow in the group itself. And that's an open research question, try to understand where colony level memory is stored. But at the colony level, there seems to be a colony level phenotype here, a colony level anticipation of this, or a colony level time place learning. So maybe colony level cognition is an example here. But maybe there are other explanations. It might be, there could be some environmental cue like the sun that somehow you could sort of explain this that, well, they're actually learning that. There might be a delay, but whenever the sun is in the sky at a particular point, they tend to get, but they still have to know which place to come back to. But there could be some behaviorist explanation that would help sort of explain using more traditional associative learning this result. But it's compelling to sort of think that maybe it's time place learning, maybe it's cognition. Questions about these data, about the setup here? It's very similar to the kookaburra, but It's at the colony level. Okay. Another, example here, awareness of self, another thing we associate with cognition. So this self-awareness here, the ability of an animal to separate its concept of its own body, self, from the bodies of others. A common test of the awareness of self is the so-called mirror test. An animal passes the mirror test when it directs behavior back toward itself after an object is added, only after information becomes available through a mirror. So, as an example, you might have an elephant and you put something, you paint a dot on them. Maybe it's a yellow dot. And then maybe on a control group of elements, it's a dot that is the same color as their skin. And then you bring both elephants toward a mirror, you unveil the mirror, and when the elephant sees itself in the mirror, it brings its trunk up and it touches the dot if it's yellow, and it doesn't touch it if it's skin colored. That would be an example of the mirror test. And so the elephant only touched its head after it saw the reflection of itself. So it was aware that it exists in the world. It's aware of its own self, and it was aware that it was seeing a reflection of itself, and it was using that information to redirect its behavior back to itself. That's the so-called mirror test, a common test for looking for the awareness of self, which we view as a cognitive property. So that's kind of an example here. There are some ants that appear to pass the mirror test, although I think this study, people are very kind of critical of it. There are chimps that pass the mirror test. The mirror test has been done with a lot of different animals. Questions about the mirror test, the idea here. Now, if we think about the umwelt of an animal, we have to sort of think about what type of mirror is best fit for the animal for this. So, would we expect a lobster to be able to do this? Is a lobster, do they have the visual system and do they have the ability to respond to that visual input? If you were to, if a lobster failed the mirrors test, if you put a lobster in front of here and it didn't touch the part of the cuticle that you've painted, then what does that mean about the lobster? Does that mean it doesn't have the awareness of self? And so to get to these umwelt sort of questions, people have developed other types of mirror tests that exist in other modalities. So there's this olfactory mirror test that people have done with dogs, for example. And so the idea here is you can give a dog an odor of that smells just like itself, or you can give it an odor that smells like other dogs, or you can gradually perturb that odor. And this paper suggests that dogs will investigate things that smell like them much longer than things that smell like other dogs or other items. And this, they suggest, is an olfactory mirror test that suggests that the dog knows what it smells like, so it must know that it exists as a separate part of the world. It has the awareness of self, and it responds to that by responding to its own odor differently than it responds to others. Maybe. People are very critical of these olfactory mirror tests, and so this is a review where they sort of suggest that there's all sorts of other explanations, classical explanations or associative learning explanations that could suggest this, that could predict the results of these olfactory mirror tests. And I think this paper goes even farther to suggest that that there've been, if you look at all of the evidence of self-recognition in any non-human animal, you can break them all down, even the visual mirror tests. So there are a lot of people that are just not very convinced. Just like in Tolman's rats, there are still people to this day that's still debated, whether rats are forming cognitive maps or whether it's something else going on. So it's an active area of discussion, but it's an interesting discussion. So that's really, if science is seeding interesting and fruitful discussions, then I think that's still a success, even if we're not answering the question perfectly yet. Okay. So that was the mirror test. So any questions about the mirror test, this idea of self? Right. So once you have an awareness of your own mind, then a higher level cognitive property is the awareness of other minds. So, how do you, so we our experience, our introspective experience suggests that I look out at you and I say, oh man, they look like they're really bored right now. Let's just pull through this, or maybe I need to stop and everybody stand up or whatever. That's theory of mind. That's my view is I look at your expressions. I try to make an inference about what you might be thinking based on your expressions, based on what I might be thinking if I was making those expressions. That's what I mean, theory of mind. So then the suggestion would be, do other animals have a theory of mind? And it's an interesting thought, but then it's hard to test. So one of the common tests for theory of mind is so-called gaze following. So theory of mind is the ability to form hypotheses about the thoughts of surrounding animals like you guys. And one of the things is gaze following, the ability to identify an object another individual is paying attention to by observing the gaze of that individual. So if I look at that fire extinguisher, and I don't say that I'm looking at that fire extinguisher, if I'm just looking at a fire extinguisher, and if Anushka and Sean look at you, they could record how many people also look at that fire extinguisher. And by following your gaze, then it's a suggestion that you know that there are thought processes going on in my head that are focusing on that thing. And it suggests then that you have a theory of mind. You have a theory of how my mind works, and you're using that. And we can do the same thing with animals. So we can look at what they look like. And so this has been done with dogs, Dexter. This has been done with chimpanzees and other animals as well. And so they set up these things, they show model animals looking at things, and they might be model humans. In the case of dogs, people have said, can your dog follow your gaze? And Dexter seems to be able to follow my gaze. If I look at something, if I say, find it, and that's something I've tried and trained him to do, he'll search around the house for a treat that I've hid. And then if he comes back to me and he can't find it, if I say, find it, and then I look in the right direction, then he tends to go in that direction. So he seems to know, but there are other explanations for what he's doing there. But that is at least a base level test of gaze following. Does the animal look where a model animal is looking? Gaze following. Questions about that example? All right. So, almost done here. I mentioned this example before. Another example of theory of mind. We've already talked about this, but if you have an animal that caches, it will recache a lot more when another animal's watching it. Another example of theory of mind. All right, so wrapping up here, there's lots more examples here. Investigations of cognition that do not match a particular set of these things, but the general insight is it's do you need to assert the idea of a mind in order to explain the behavior? All right, and I'll skip this example because I was going a little slower than usual here. Hermit crabs, another really interesting example of that. You can take a look at it in the slides, but keep you guys on time. I'll just do a poll here to close out. And so what is gaze following used to assess? Is it self-recognition, theory of mind, or mental time travel? Otherwise, have a good weekend. We'll see you next week for communication.